To Letters and Politics, I'm Mitch Jezrich, and now joining me is Elizabeth Gillespie McCrae. Elizabeth Gillespie McCrae is Associate Professor of History and Director of the Graduate Social Science Education Programs at Western Carolina University in North Carolina, and she is the author of a book that we will be in conversation about. It's called Mothers of Massive Resistance, White Women and the Politics of White Supremacy. Elizabeth Gillespie McCrae, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Thank you for having me.
Why tell this story?
Well, the short answer is I've been working on it for about 17 years, so
17,
I'm glad to, yeah, so I'm glad to finally tell the story. I think it's important for us to sort of expand our knowledge of political organization and organizing to take white women who have campaigned for segregationist sort of social orders across the country seriously. And I think for a long time, when we studied white political mobilization, we studied white women who sort of expanded democracy and who pushed for maybe more progressive politics. But those groups, while they're really important, have a hard time explaining, I think, the persistence of inequity in this country and how it's sustained at a local level. So I think the study of women in particular, or in general, and white women in particular, lets us look at political mobilization on a more local and sort of grassroots level. So that's sort of what I was interested in.
And we want to dive into the story, but let me ask you, you said you've been working on this issue, the topic, for 17 years. How so? What is it about this that, I mean, I hear what you just said about why you tell this story.
Right.
But how did you get onto this story?
When I was fishing around for a dissertation topic, I was really interested in sort of the politics around public education and also became interested in women who opposed the 19th Amendment. So like, why would women oppose getting the right to vote? And as I was looking through archives and reading the things that anti-suffrage women said, a lot of anti-suffragists and suffragists who were women had in the South had promised that their votes would uphold the Jim Crow order, uphold racial segregation rather than weaken it. And so I decided I would sort of track down whether that was just a political strategy or whether they in fact did do that, and if so, how. And so I began to travel around the South looking at archives, trying to read white women's papers to see the kinds of things they were doing.
That's interesting, because when you talk about the connection to the suffragist movement and perhaps opposing, as you said, the 19th Amendment of the United States Constitution, another parallel to all this, and you chronicle four women: Nell Battle Lewis, Florence Sillars Ogden, Mary Dawson Kane, and Cornelia Dabney Tucker. And in chronicling them and in their effort to enforce segregation or even oppose desegregation, they were also very much involved in trying to undo the New Deal, trying to undo Social Security.
Right. Some of them, certainly Mary Dawson Kane, who was early in the New Deal, was a New Deal supporter, and she had a blue eagle in her newspaper office and her husband at the gas station, but they change pretty quickly. So by 1936, she is an opponent of the New Deal and will become a vehement opponent of Social Security and of the sort of expansion of the federal bureaucracy. Cornelia Dabney Tucker tells the story that she's sort of politically mobilized by President Roosevelt's attempts to expand the court. And so she moves from there into a larger critique of the New Deal. The other two women have a more positive relationship with the New Deal for longer. But by the end of World War II, they have begun to sort of attack New Deal policies and Roosevelt in particular.
Also very much related to the Cold War.
Right. So as the Cold War took shape, but the Soviet Union begins to condemn in their press racist atrocities in the United States and racial inequities in the United States, the link between sort of communism and civil rights activism becomes one that these women misconstrue, I think, in some ways, and use that to sort of link opposition to the civil rights movement to anti-communism.
That's interesting. Let's look at some of these women. Let's start with Nell Battle Lewis. And my understanding, now, many of these women actually were columnists and writers. And Nell Battle Lewis wrote for Raleigh News and Observer. She started off as a progressive.
Right. Very iconoclastic, sort of made her name in the 1920s as coming out against the Klan, criticizing the Daughters of the American Revolution, supporting labor organizing and labor uprisings in North Carolina, which was vehemently anti-union. But she always believed that sort of white, enlightened progressives should be in charge of sort of racial progress. And so she would highlight, in ways that other segregationist women did not, she would highlight Langston Hughes's poetry and defend him coming and speaking at the University of North Carolina when other people were condemning that as a violation of the Jim Crow order. And she celebrated black educational institutions. And so she seemed for the time to be very sort of progressive, even in her understanding of Southern race relations. She condemned the violence of the Klan and condemned vigilante violence in general. But she thought that people like her should direct race relations, not African Americans themselves. So I think her, over time, her position becomes untenable with greater and greater black mobilization and black political successes in the South.
How did she foresee that she and white progressives should sort of control the advancement of, what we say, of equality of races?
Well, she's intriguing in a host of ways, but I think it wasn't that she didn't believe in racial segregation. She criticized that separate but equal was not honored, so that there should be equal facilities and there should be equal treatment and there should be equal opportunity, but she never questioned. So she lobbied for the equality part, but believed that equality and separateness could coexist. So she critiqued how the Jim Crow order was enacted and implemented and practiced, not the sort of principle behind separate but equal.
Can you talk to me the effect that the Cold War would then have on her? Did she remain a progressive? And she was quite active in writing this column for the Raleigh News and Observer from 1920 to 1956. She died in 56, correct?
Right, yeah. Right. So you see some fault lines beginning in World War II. And there was this book put out by UNC Press called What the Negro Wants. And it had essays from a really diverse set of African American writers and educators. And when that came out, without fail, all of the essayists condemned racial segregation. And she was stunned by that, even though she had read many of the writers in this collection before. And so her response to that call for an end to sort of racial segregation in the middle of the war was that those black elites did not speak for kind of the black working class, and that they were misguided in their efforts. So I think even before the Cold War that you saw some fractures in Nell Battle Lewis's, well, you saw where her politics were going to go. And the Cold War, for Lewis, the rise of sort of the prominence of some communists in North Carolina, and particularly at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, made her alarmed, because these student sort of lefties were also calling for racial equality. And so that was the link for her that sort of pushed her. So the combination of that and African Americans who she had sort of previously praised now calling for an end to racial segregation, sort of without asking for white permission to do that. Those two things sort of pushed her to be one of the architects of opposition to the civil rights movement in North Carolina.
It could be argued that in the 20th century, especially the early 20th century, that the communists in the United States, not talking about Russia here, but American communists, were ahead of rest of society when it came to racial equality.
Right, and there's a book, Glenda Gilmore, Defying Dixie, that looks at how African Americans who were interested in the labor movement found the early Communist Party a place that met both their quest for racial equality and addressed the sort of issues of the working class in the United States. I mean, there's not a ton, right? But there is that certainly historical element.
And you have a history of communists in North Carolina. I did not know that. I shouldn't be too surprised, I guess.
I mean, I don't want to overplay it, but some of the labor organizers in the strikes in 1929 were associated with the Communist Party, and even Nell Battle Lewis defended in the 1920s, defended working class folks who turned to what she perceived as more radical political platforms. And she explained it as a failure of white progressives and white elites and white conservatives to address what she felt like were the ravages of capitalism in that time period, like in the textile industry in particular.
We're in conversation with Elizabeth Gillespie McCrae. She is the author of the book called Mothers of Massive Resistance, White Women and the Politics of White Supremacy. I want to talk about another woman that you profile in your book, Elizabeth Gillespie McCrae, and that is Cornelia Dabney Tucker, who was from South Carolina. And you mentioned this earlier. She started as opposing Franklin Delano Roosevelt's attempt to increase the numbers of people that served on the Supreme Court. Can you talk to me about that dynamic and maybe just a little background on that effort by FDR?
Probably I could talk less on that effort of FDR as I can the dynamic. But I think by his second term, a number of his policies had been restricted by Supreme Court decisions. And so, and he's wildly popular, right? In particular, in the South. One of his proposals is to expand the Supreme Court, which would have given him a series of appointments. And I guess with the eye, right, that he could have changed the dynamic on the Supreme Court. Across the country, this was not as popular as it was in the South. So the South, more than any other region of the country, supported the expansion of the court. Not everybody, but like more than the other regions. And so Tucker in South Carolina is alarmed by what she says. This is sort of a constitutional overreach. And this is the moment of her sort of political awakening, she says. I came across her. I was looking, I don't remember the process, but she has a memoir called The First, or a book written about her, and it's called The First Republican Southern Belle. That's the moment that she decides that the South needs to move out of this sort of blind loyalty to the Democratic Party. And it's at this moment that Roosevelt has proposed the expansion of the court, and she conducts a nationwide campaign.
And she started, Cornelia Dabney Tucker started out as a Democrat, would become a Republican. Did she predate? I mean, obviously, we think of the Southern strategy. We're thinking more of Nixon,
right,
which came later. But was this part of that entire transformation that was happening with the flipping of the parties when it came to race relations?
So I think these women are earlier than, so they're all Democrats initially. And Tucker will be the first one to leave. The others, it will take a little longer to move. Mary Dawson Kane begins to critique the national, as does Florence Sellers Ogden, the National Democratic Party, certainly by World War II, although they remain Democrats at the state level. Right, 'cause there's really no game in town in the South if you're white and not a Democrat. But I think one thing that comes out of these women's stories is that they begin to sort of sow the seeds of partisan dissent early, like earlier than the shift will come with the rest of the South, right? With Nixon's Southern strategy. Like, this is decades before that. But they began to cultivate sort of the landscape of that, I think.
And they do this through their columns, other ways as well?
Right. So they do it through... So three of those four women are columnists. Cornelia Dabney Tucker is not a columnist, although she writes a lot, and it is in the paper, both her actions and she writes lots of letters to the editor. But, yeah, so they cultivate that through their columns, but they're also very tapped in to both women's networks, like different women's organizations, to state-level partisan organizations, and to eventually, by the 1950s, to national networks of conservatives. So while those four form the sort of narrative thread of the story, they provide access in their correspondence and in their work in a variety of organizations to national networks of women that are... Not that these women are famous, but are even less sort of accessible, except through the sort of correspondence and, you know, PTA work and things like that.
Grassroots?
Yes.
And that's how they did this, through all these meetings and clubs, women clubs?
Clubs, right. So some that... like the DAR and the UDC are some that maybe people are more familiar with. But then groups like the business and professional women, like these women are very, you know, they're well educated. Like my four main characters are well educated. They have sort of followers, right, that read their columns that aren't always overtly political, right? They might write about daffodils in the spring one week, you know. And so those organizations, some of them begin to join. There's a kind of conservative umbrella organization called the Congress of Freedom in the 1950s. And a number of the women find their way into that organization that's both men and women. Yeah, they're very busy. So through those organizations, through the PTA, through local meetings... two of the women, the Mississippi women, Kane and Ogden, are involved in the creation of this organization called Women for Constitutional Government that comes after the after James Meredith integrates the University of Mississippi. That's their response, is to form.
And what is that response for what was it, the defense of the Constitution or?
The Women for Constitutional Government? It is an organization that began under the premise that the integration of the University of Mississippi was a constitutional overreach by the federal government. And so they formed this organization to uphold what they see are conservative principles, and they name it the Women for Constitutional Government because they don't want the sort of white supremacist piece to be the centerpiece. They want to be able to build a more national movement. And so by calling their organization the Women for Constitutional Government, they can emphasize that... what they would call the forced integration of the University of Mississippi and of Central High School in Little Rock, right, was a constitutional crisis. So they move... It's not a wildly popular organization, right? It doesn't ever reach the sort of national level that the founders imagined, although there's organizations in Chicago and Texas and a lot of other states, but it's not like as powerful as the DAR even. But they hope that they move towards a colorblind political language. And I think the Women for Constitutional Government lets us see that about how these women that have supported racial racial segregation, began to try to cultivate a larger movement of which racial segregation and white supremacist politics are just one element.
That's interesting. So a change from trying to uphold, promote segregation, perhaps oppose desegregation, but then moving into now what we want is policies that don't, what, mention race?
Well, they're careful not to mention it as frequently as they have mentioned it previously. Does that make sense? So right by the 60s, these women understand that they're experiencing real losses in sort of being able to uphold legal segregation. I mean, the Civil Rights Act will be in 64, the Voting Rights Act in 1965. They had anticipated, many of them, the Brown decision at least 2 years before it was, you know, they're reading a lot and they're talking to political actors a lot. And so they realize that they're losing the sort of legal segregation battle, but they understand that there's ways to sort of reconfigure it. And to continue, right? The Jim Crow order in the South is just one articulation of white supremacist politics. And so they understand that they can push for kind of customary segregation nationwide, but also that they can repackage their politics in this sort of more colorblind language.
So again, Elizabeth Gillespie McRae, in your book, Mothers of Massive Resistance, you do chronicle these four women, Nell Battle Lewis, Florence Sillars Ogden, Mary Dawson Kane, and Cornelia Dabney Tucker. And working on this project, and just even over the last 17 years, have you talked or been in communication with their families?
So I did interview and meet Florence Sillars Ogden's nephew and his wife. And when I was doing research in Cleveland, Mississippi, they had me to the house and talked to me about their aunt. I was very thankful for that. Showed me where, you know, I got to see where she had lived and all of that. The Mary Dawson Kane and Nell Battle Lewis did not have children. And so I didn't talk to anybody in their sort of direct family. And then Cornelia Dabney Tucker was sort of the last of the main characters, is the last one I came to. And so, no, I read her material, and but I did not talk to her family.
Looking at Mary Dawson Kane, brought her up several times now. She ran for governor in 1951. How successful was that?
Well, she wasn't that successful. Oh, it's pretty notable that she's running for governor, and she runs for governor again as well. But she ran as the sort of candidate of principle, right? And that she wasn't beholden to like partisan quid pro quos, that she was the real conservative candidate. And while she wasn't successful in her gubernatorial races, it did give her a chance to sort of expand her conservative credentials. And also, I mean, sometimes she spoke in three different places in a day. Like, you know, yes, and would go around, you know, and this would help her. She's works really hard after 1951 for a group called Democrats for Eisenhower. So Democratic folks in the South who wanted to cross over and vote for a Republican candidate in 1952. And Kane and a number of other of the women I write about were really pushed for white women to come out and vote for the real conservative, who they believed was Eisenhower.
Again, a precursor to the Southern strategy.
Right.
And finally, what do you think, what place do these four women and what they were doing in networking, and were they just targeting women? for their ideas?
No, they were not just targeting women. I think most of their networks, well, that's not true. So Florence Sillars Ogden was sort of embedded in a lot of women's networks, the UDC, the DAR. These other women focus, I mean, they have access to women's organizations, right, just by the kind of structure of society at that time. But they are also, they move in and out. They're in conversation with men, too. And they, in fact, have a critique of men that they make over time, that men, because of their loyalty to party, are not as ideologically pure as women political actors can be, right? Because they're so used to committees and national platforms and even state-level platforms and who they need, the support they need to get elected or get legislation through, that these women couch white women as, like, the more principled political actors.
Did any of them ever see themselves as potentially being on the wrong side of history? Some lived into the 1980s?
Right. Kane did. So I don't trace much past 1974, but no. I mean, until that point, they do not see themselves on the wrong side of history.
True believers.
Right. I mean, Nell Battle Lewis, who dies very unexpectedly in 1956... was celebrating that what she thought was resignation in 1954 or capitulation to school integration had developed into a very well-organized resistance by the time of her death.
And there was a strong organized resistance to Brown versus Board of Education.
Yes.
Elizabeth Gillespie McRae has been our guest. Again, she's Associate Professor of History and Director of Graduate Social Science Education Programs at Western Carolina University in North Carolina. And she is the author of the book that we have been in conversation about. It's called Mothers of Massive Resistance, White Women and the Politics of White Supremacy. Elizabeth Gillespie McRae, I've enjoyed our conversation and I thank you greatly.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That does it for Letters in Politics. Deanna Martinez is our producer. Lucille Rousseau is our intern. And Kirsten Thomas is our engineer. You can listen to our archive shows at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jesrich, and I thank you for listening.
By negating the votes of more than a million African Americans, Latinos, and Asian American voters. Talk about Russians all you want, but if we don't stop another purge, the 2018 midterm will be lost, along with democracy itself. This is Dennis Bernstein inviting you to a one-time-only screening of Greg Palast's new revised film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, The Case of the Stolen Election. This happens at Grand Lake Theater, 3200 Grand Avenue in Oakland, Wednesday evening, April 18th, 7 p.m. Greg Palast will be there with me for a discussion following this masterpiece of investigative journalism.